All right, get my recorder going. Did anybody get to my website and see the recordings and the notes and the PowerPoint? Okay, so if you got lost yesterday a little bit, same thing today. The notes will be posted, the PowerPoint will be posted, and the audio will be posted. Unfortunately, my recorder died about 45 minutes before the end of the class. So I only got about 80% of the class, but it was recorded here as well, yes? You guys got it? Great. All right, so I'm going to do a class on the book of Daniel. Actually, I wrote a book on Daniel. There's a couple copies back there. If you want to pick up a copy, I have a few others back at the hotel if you run out. All right, so the theme of Daniel is this. God rules the nations. Do not fear. Do you believe that God's in control? Well, you're at a Christian meeting. You're supposed to say that. Do you really, really believe that God rules the nations, that He's in control of your life? Because if you do, it'll affect the way you act. If we really trust that God's in control, it's going to have a big effect on our lives. So there are two messages in Daniel. Number one, how to stay righteous in a world that's doing everything to destroy your commitment and righteousness to God. The other one is that God is in control. Now, to understand the book of Daniel, you have to understand the background. Daniel in the Old Testament is Revelation in the New Testament. The purpose of the books are similar. The messages of the books are similar. In both cases, what you have is a message delivered to people who are suffering extreme persecution. In the case of Revelation, the audience is the Christians, 1st, 2nd, and 3rd century, who are suffering persecution under the Romans. In the case of the book of Daniel, the audience of the book is the Jews suffering in persecution under Antiochus Epiphanes. How many of you know who Antiochus Epiphanes is? I thought so. All right, so we're going to have a little bit of historical background in order to understand the book. Now, of course, as with Revelation, it has a general message for everybody, but it's helpful to understand the historical background. All right, so here's a very, very brief outline of the book of Daniel. Chapters 1, 3, 4, 5, and 6 are practical stories of Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and the world is trying to undermine their righteousness, trying to get them to compromise with their convictions, and, of course, they hold fast in their convictions. The rest of the book is visions of the future, chapters 2 and 7 through 12. Amazing visions of the future with fantastic details in the prophecies. Now, a good question would be, how are these two parts related? How are the visions of the future related to the other message, which is staying faithful in your situation? And here's the thing. In the prophetic parts in Daniel, we understand that God raises up kings, takes them out, creates nations, moves nations to do things. God controls the future. And the smallest detail in terms of kings and nations and tribes and His people, and if God can do that, do you think He can take care of your financial situation? Do you think He can take care of your work situation? Do you think He can take care of your health situation? By the way, just because God's in control doesn't mean everything's going to go awesome all the time. You understand that, right? Because God's what God has in mind for you is better than what you have in mind for yourself. And it may include some things that you're not really all that fired up about. All right? Now, Daniel is an unusual book. If you go to the library, they have certain genres, right? You have your literature and your poetry and your history. But Daniel is a book. There's a genre in the library. There's only one book. Because Daniel is a history book of the future. You don't have a lot of those. If you go to the library and say, do you have any history books of the future? They'll look at you like, what are you talking about? We don't have those things. And Daniel, I mean, the prophecies in Daniel predict the minutest possible things hundreds of years before. And what it shows is two things. Number one, the Bible is inspired by God.
Yeah.
And number two, that God rules the nations. So that's the role of the prophetic material. Now, my intention this morning is to only give you a feeling for the practical examples, because those are fairly easy to understand. You know, you read about the writing on the wall, Daniel chapter 5, not too hard to figure out. Daniel chapter 4, where Nebuchadnezzar's his pride and all that sort of stuff. So I'm going to do a little bit of study in Daniel 1, a little bit of study in Daniel 3, but we'll spend most of our time looking at the prophetic material, because that's the stuff that, without a little bit of historical background, a little bit of study, you could probably get a little bit confused, okay? So that's what we're going to do here. All right. Now, I have to give historical background. Just like with the book of Revelation, the book of Daniel has a definite historical setting. The difference is, with Revelation, I think everybody here already knew about the history of the church and the fact that there were persecutions, yes?
Yeah.
So let's give a little bit of background. First of all, the northern kingdom sinned even more than the southern kingdom, as you know. And so in 722 BC, the Sennacherib came from Assyria and completely destroyed Samaria and deported the 10 tribes. Yes? Judah was more faithful. And there were good kings like Hezekiah and Josiah. But eventually, they were completely involved in idolatry as well. So God chose to destroy the southern kingdom, as he had prophesied in Deuteronomy 28 and 29 in great detail. So in 605 BC, Nebuchadnezzar, the Babylonian king, he comes to Jerusalem. He didn't destroy the city. Basically, the Jews said, we surrender. All right? And he took captives with him, a number of basically children of the royal family. And that included Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And he held them as hostages. He said, you pay the tribute. If you don't, we have your children. Now, foolishly, King Jehoiakim rebelled. So Nebuchadnezzar came back. The year was 597 BC. And this time he tore down part of the wall. And he took Jehoiakim, took his eyes out, and took him as captive. At that time, he took 10,000, the cream of the crop, as captives to Babylon. And you can read about what happened to those people when you read the book of Ezekiel. All right, and then he left Jehoiakim's uncle Zedekiah as a king. Zedekiah was a weak king who gave in to the will of the people. And so foolishly, he rebelled against Nebuchadnezzar again. So Nebuchadnezzar came back in 586 BC. You can see all this up on the screen, right? He came back in 586 BC, and this time he destroyed the temple, he destroyed the city, and almost the entire population was either killed or deported. And those who left behind, Gedaliah was in charge, and they rebelled against him. They went down to Egypt. Total disaster. Now, Was that a yawn that came from you? That's okay. It's okay. It's early in the morning. All right. Amen. All right. Now, Jeremiah in chapter 24 and 29 said 70 years. The time of the captivity would be 70 years. Daniel went into captivity in roughly 605 BC. So he was a teenager at the time, as were Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. So then, almost 70 years later, Cyrus came, as prophesied by Isaiah. Cyrus came, and he basically conquered Babylon. He killed King Belshazzar. You can read about that in Daniel chapter 5. And then they sent some of the captives back to Jerusalem. Cyrus said to rebuild the temple and begin to worship God again in Jerusalem. But for some strange reason, not strange reason, basically they got caught up in all their business and all their, building their really nice houses. So they didn't build the temple. So finally, King Darius said, hey guys, build the temple. And the temple is finally built in 516 BC, exactly 70 years after they were taken away in captivity. Anyway, the Persians ruled for quite a while. And the Persians, it was an interesting empire. King Cyrus was the head of that empire. And there's the Persians and the Medes. It was an unusual empire. It was like a dual empire. We had a Persian king and a Median king. And they ruled. You had Darius and Xerxes and Artaxerxes. But then that kingdom was replaced by Alexander. Let me show you a little bit about these kingdoms. All right, here's the kingdom of Babylon, headed by Nebuchadnezzar. Here's the Persian Empire, a vast empire. All right. But then in 334 BC, Alexander the Great, who was a Macedonian, he conquered Greece and he crossed into Asia. Alexander had an army of 30,000 and the Persians had a standing army of 200,000. And yet, 3 years later, Alexander destroyed the entire Persian Empire, setting up the Greek Empire. All right? But at the age of 35, Alexander died. And when he died, the generals fought amongst themselves. And finally, four separate dynasties came from Alexander and ruled the Greek world for many, many years. Okay, one of those guys was a guy named Seleucus. And he had, there was a series of kings. And there's a guy named Antiochus Epiphanes. He was a Greek king. And I'll tell you more about him later. But the bottom line is what he did was he decided to force the Jews to accept Greek culture and Greek religion. And so what he did was he came in, he desecrated the temple, he slaughtered pigs and smeared the blood of pigs all over the holy place and the Holy of Holies. And then he put a statue of Zeus right above where the Holy of Holies, where the ark was. But the face on the statue is the face of Antiochus Epiphanes. This was the most terrible persecution the Jews had ever undergone. And by the way, of course, all this is prophesied in Daniel. But the purpose of Daniel is to prepare the Jews for that terrible situation. If you want to read about that, you can read the book of 1 Maccabees and also 2 Maccabees. Now, you're saying, where's the book of 1 Maccabees? Well, if you have a Catholic Bible or the New Jerusalem, it's in the Apocrypha. You can read a lot about that. A terrible time of persecution. But then, after 3 years, Jacob Maccabeus rebelled against Antiochus Epiphanes, kicked them out of Jerusalem, reestablished the worship. The celebration is the Jewish feast of Purim. And we call that Hanukkah. Yes, Hanukkah is a celebration. You've heard of Hanukkah. Anyway, so then the Maccabees ruled. But then in 63 BC, the Romans came. Pompey came and kicked out the Maccabees. And it became the period of Roman rule. All right. And then around 5 BC, in an obscure village in the region known as Galilee, a son was born. Actually, he was born in Bethlehem. Well, the rest of the story, I think you know. Yes? All right. So that's kind of the historical background. All right. And I probably missed a few things. We'll talk a little bit about the Roman Empire. All this is predicted by Daniel. Okay. So let's talk about Daniel chapter 1 briefly. Turn to Daniel. Okay. Now remember, Daniel 1 and 3 through 6 are stories about these youths who are being challenged by the world to compromise their convictions and how they hold up under those pressures. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord delivered Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hands, along with some of the articles from the temple of God. These he carried off to the temple of his God in Babylonia and put them in the treasure house of his God. Then the king ordered Ashpenaz, chief of the court officials, to bring some of the king's into the king's service, some of the Israelites from the royal line and ability, young men without any physical defect. We know who he's talking about. This is Daniel, Hananiah, Azariah, and Mishael. All right, now notice it says, who delivered Israel into the hand of Nebuchadnezzar? God delivered it. Every time you see historical things happening in the book of Daniel, it gives credit to God, both good and bad. When good things happen, it gives credit to God. When bad things happen, it gives credit to God. So anyway, so basically, Daniel, Hananiah, Azariah, and Mishael are taken in, and what Nebuchadnezzar wants to do is make them good servants of Babylon. So what he does is he gives them training and he changes their name. Instead of Daniel, Belshazzar. Instead of Hananiah, Shadrach, etc. And basically he's trying to make them into Babylonians. Now, Bel was one of the chief gods of the Babylonians. So imagine a Jewish teenager being given the name of a pagan god. For the rest of his life, he's known by a pagan god. In fact, all four of them were named after pagan gods. And what he's trying to do is he's trying to get them to reject their Jewish background to accept Babylonian culture and religion. All right? And so imagine you're a teenager. You have no Bible, no church, all right? No disciples, if you will, nothing backing them up. Are they going to stay faithful? So anyway, the king says, we're going to train you, and they're going to give you all this great food and awesome clothing. And Daniel says, no, we refuse to compromise our convictions and eat this unclean food. So to me, Daniel chapter 1 is about this. Are you going to stay righteous despite pressures from your work situation? A lot of us have jobs where they expect us to compromise our Christian conviction. You know, just a little corruption. Just a few lies. And we say to ourselves, well, you know, God gave me this job, so he wouldn't have given me this job if he didn't want me to kind of, you know, go along. You know, we could easily have that thinking. And these guys, they're just teenagers. They're like 14, 15, maybe 16 years old. They don't have disciples. They don't have the Holy Spirit. They don't have the prophecies fulfilled. All they have is their faith in God. And yet they say, basically, you can keep your job. So Daniel says, here, test us. And, you know, I think about this. Our job is a great place for our faith to be tested. You know, when your boss tells you to be corrupt, what a great opportunity to say, sir, you can fire me, but I'm not going to be corrupt. You know, I remember one time I was on the job. I shared my faith with one of my students. I was a professor, and, you know, she was studying the Bible, and we're counting the costs with her, and her mother called the president of the university and said, you know, I send my child off to this Catholic college. Now she's going to the church with her professor. What's up with that? So they called me in, and I had a little discussion. You know what happened is, because of that incident, when I came up for tenure, they denied me tenure. All right? I'm like, awesome. Wouldn't that be great to be fired because of your convictions? Wouldn't that be great? But here's what happened. The next year, that president got fired. And I got tenure. Amen. But you know what? Even if it hadn't happened that way, it doesn't change what we're going to do, does it? You know, all of us will be in situations. It's going to happen. Because what the world wants to do is they see the people who are trying to behave righteous. And they say, I got to cut that person down. You know, I got to find a way to get them. Because they want you to join with them in their sin. Because you make them look bad. You make them look bad. So let's take the advantage of Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, and Daniel. Basically, they said, here, just give us vegetables. Let the other guys have their meat, all their friends would give us vegetables. And after 10 days, see who looks better. And after 10 days, they were all buff. And, you know, and they said, we're going to make all the other guys eat vegetables too. I'm sure they weren't too happy about that. All right. And then when it came time to be presented before the king, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and Daniel were smarter, were more educated, answered the questions better. And now, I really believe that if we put God first, He's going to take care of us because God's in control. Does that mean He's going to give us a better job? Probably, but maybe not. Because what He's going to give you is better, and the bottom line is your job does not determine whether you have a good life or not. Notice this. In Daniel 1 verse 2 it says, "And the Lord delivered Jehoiakim." In Daniel 1 9 it says, "God caused the official to show favor to Daniel." In Daniel 1 17 it says, "God gave them knowledge and understanding." And in Daniel 1 8 says, "Daniel resolved not to defile himself." Brothers and sisters, let's decide today that we'll never, ever compromise our Christian convictions. If they tell us we have to miss church for our job, we say, "I'm sorry, but I don't miss church for my job." You know, there's two possibilities. Either they'll fire you, and God will probably give you a better job, or they'll appreciate your convictions. All right? I don't know which it'll be. All right? Please test your servants. All right, so that's kind of what's going on in Daniel chapter 1. All right. So Daniel chapter 3. So Daniel chapter 1 is an example of being righteous on the job, essentially. To me, Daniel chapter 3 is being righteous when the religious people are trying to get you to compromise your convictions. That's a big thing here, definitely in Nigeria. There's so much compromise. You know, it is interesting that the most religious country in the world is one of the most corrupt countries in the world. You're so religious and yet so ungodly. Now, I don't say that to be critical of it. I'm just describing the situation. All right? But I'm telling you, I'm sure it's very tempting for the church to be like the world. But let's look at Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. All right? So, what happens here is, let me see if I got a, yeah, no, okay. So Nebuchadnezzar makes a massive statue, 30 meters tall, and he has a big party, not in the city, there's no place big enough to hold the whole population, so out in the plains of Dura, they set up this statue, and he says, "All right, everybody come to this party. Guess who's invited? Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego." All right, so there's tens of thousands. And there's this big stage. On top of the stage is Nebuchadnezzar, his chief officials, and a fiery furnace. And he says, "When you hear the sound of the zither and the flute and the harp, we want everybody to bow down to that statue." Now, what would you have done? I mean, the choice is bow down to that statue or go into the fiery furnace. What would you have done? I think we should be careful in answering that question. I don't know if you've ever been in a situation quite like that. You know, what I would have done, I would have said, you know, it's just a stupid statue. Didn't Paul say eating meat sacrificed to idols is not a big deal because the idol's nothing anyway? You know, and is it a sin to bow? You know? If it's a sin to bow, then all our friends in Japan are in big trouble, you know? It's not a sin to bow. So, you know, I'll bow my head, but not my heart. That'd been pretty tempting, you know? Not a big deal. Would Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego have gone to hell if they bowed down to that statue? Would they have lost their salvation if they did that? I don't know. Anybody here ever sinned since you were baptized? Raise your hand if you've sinned at least one. All right. So you're going to judge Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego on that one? You know, but that's not the point. The point is God rules the nations, and either you believe that or you don't believe it. And if you believe it, it's going to control how you act. Right? And you have to understand, the context of Daniel is, this is written to the Jews suffering extreme persecution under Antiochus Epiphanes. Antiochus said, you have to take part in the Greek games, and you can't circumcise your children. So would you have circumcised your children? In fact, if you read in 2 Maccabees, what he did was he said, if you circumcise your married child, first we'll kill your child, then we'll kill your wife, and then we'll kill you. And that's exactly what happened. I guarantee you, a majority of the Jews said, never mind, you know, we're probably not going to circumcise our children. But those who believe that God rules the nations could read Daniel chapter 3 and say, hey, you know what? We're not going to compromise, even if it means death. And many, many were killed. You can read stories about that in 1st and 2nd Maccabees. So anyway, first time I did this lesson in Nigeria, we did the object lesson. Everybody stood up, and then I had everybody sit down, and Shadrach, nice object lesson here, stood up. So anyway, so they sound the horn, the flute, the zither, and the lyre. Tens of thousands of people bow down. And those teenagers, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, stood tall for God. You know, sometime in your life, you're going to have a moment like that. I don't know when it's going to come. But when it's going to come, are you going to stand up for God? Or are you going to not stand up for God? And you know, we have to look at those as opportunities to give glory to God. And I believe some of you, God will put you in a dangerous situation. And you have to ask yourself, how are you going to respond? You know, this also would apply to the Christians. I'm sure the Christians in the 1st, 2nd, and 3rd century read the book of Daniel. Because they too were put in a situation where they had to choose whether they're going to bow down to the Roman God or not. And they look at Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Now let's look what happened here. So let's do some actual reading. All right. Daniel chapter 3. Verse 13. So Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego refused to bow. How awesome a scene is that? I'm sure everybody remembered the convictions of those boys. And I'm sure many people will run to God that day. Because I'm telling you, if you're put into a Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego situation, you're going to give glory to God. A lot of people are going to say, what an idiot, what a fool. But there are those few people out there who are seeking God. And they're going to say, I want to get to know that man. I want to get to know that woman. And they're going to be won over by your actions. Furious with rage, Nebuchadnezzar summoned Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. So these men were brought before the king. Nebuchadnezzar said to them, is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the image of gold that's set up? Now when you hear the sound of the horn, flute, zither, and harp, pipe, and all other kinds of music, if you're ready to fall down and worship the image I made, very good. But if you do not worship it, you will be thrown immediately into a blazing furnace. Then what God will be able to rescue you from my hand? Not looking too good. You know, from an outward perspective, it's probably advisable to go and bow down to that statue. And Nebuchadnezzar says, what God can save you? From his perspective, who's God one? Jehovah or Baal? Baal, right? He'd already defeated their God. He'd already taken the items from their temple, and they were sitting in his treasury. He's like, pretty obvious, my God is stronger than your God. I love their response. It's awesome. Up. Hoop. Ho. Hup. Hup. It's awesome. Let's read it. If somebody can fix that, it'd be great. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego replied to him, King Nebuchadnezzar, we don't need to defend ourselves before you in this matter. Imagine this. You got it? Whew. Imagine this. Three teenagers standing in front of the most powerful man in the world who held the power of death over them. Imagine that. And they didn't have a discipler. They didn't have a church. They didn't have the prophecies fulfilled. All they had was faith in their God. You know what? They believe that God rules the nations. They believe that God's in control. And look what they said to Nebuchadnezzar. They said, if we are thrown into the blazing furnace, the God we serve is able to deliver us from it, and He will deliver us from Your Majesty's hand. But even if He does not, we want You to know, Your Majesty, that we will not serve Your gods or worship the image of gold that You've set up. They said, you know, our God can save us from the flames. But even if He doesn't, it doesn't matter. You know, God could convert your children. But even if He doesn't, I'm going to be faithful. You know, God can deliver me from this unchristian spouse. Or as a single, God can give me a husband or a wife. But even if He doesn't, we're still going to hold to our convictions. God rules the nations. That means whether it goes the way you wanted or whether it doesn't go the way you wanted, you're going to act the same way, right? That's right. And so now Nebuchadnezzar, now he's really angry. It says here, then Nebuchadnezzar was furious with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And his attitude toward them changed. He ordered the furnace heated 7 times hotter than usual. He commanded some of the strongest soldiers in the army to tie them up and to throw them into the blazing furnace. So these men, wearing their robes, trousers, turbans, and other clothes, were bound and thrown into the blazing furnace. The king's command was so urgent, the furnace was so hot, that the flames of the fire killed the soldiers who took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And these 3 men, firmly tied, fell into the blazing furnace. You know, it wasn't too late. Even as they were being dragged off to the flames, they said, wait, never mind. What were they thinking? What were they thinking as they were being dragged off to that furnace? Why did God bring us here? Why did God give us this great job? Here we've been faithful. We refused to compromise. And what happened? We're being thrown into the fiery furnace. Did they expect to be saved from the flames? I don't think so. They knew God could save them. Now, the story ends, you know the happy ending of the story, right? And Nebuchadnezzar's like, wow, that's great, and you know, there's no God but Jehovah. But you know what? I think the meaning of the story would be essentially the same, even if they'd been burned up in the fire. You know? But I'll tell you right now, when they were saved from the flames, they were fired up. That's a joke. No. They were fired up. All right, you're supposed to... Sorry, I guess that joke didn't work. All right. I saved that joke so I can use it. All right. Now, we're going to change. Now, we're not going to talk about Daniel 4, 5, or 6. Daniel showing being faithful in the job and all that sort of stuff. So what we're going to do is we're going to go to Daniel chapter 2. Now, I have to go through these visions fairly quickly. We don't have a lot of time. All right? But let's remember the connection between the prophecies of Daniel and the practical chapters. The message is staying righteous in a world that's doing anything it can to get you to compromise your convictions. You guys are too hardcore. You know, everybody has to be a disciple, give up everything. Where does it say that in the Bible? Let me share a story. It was a friend of mine. I was in graduate school, and I was just talking about him. I was talking about baptism. I don't know how it came up. He was a very, very religious guy. This is one of the most sincere religious guys I've known. And so I mentioned that in the Bible it says you need to be baptized. He says, now wait a minute. Are you telling me I'm going to hell? And I said, I'm just interpreting the Bible. No. He says, I want you to tell me right now, do you think I'm going to hell? I said, well, you know, it's not me to judge, and, you know, I'm just reading the scripture, you know. He said, no, I want to know if you think I'm going to hell. I said, yeah, I think you're going to hell. Whew. Because we can't compromise the truth. So anyway, So now we're back in Daniel chapter 2. I'll tell the story. I'll do some reading, but I mostly tell the story. So Nebuchadnezzar has a dream. And he wakes up and he realizes this dream was not like any other dream. He says, "Oh my gods!" You know, "Oh my gods." Anyway, all right. And so basically, it was like a religious experience. And he realized the gods were speaking to him. So he decided, "I need to know what this dream is about." So he brings in all his astrologers and magicians. He says, "You need to interpret the dream for me." They say, "Great, tell us the dream and we'll interpret it for you." They're all a bunch of fakers. Kind of like certain religious groups, you know, they have the miracle where they're kind of limping and then they're limping a little bit less on the other side. And, you know, they throw their wheelchair off the stage, but you see them a couple hours later, they're back in the wheelchair. You know what we're talking about.
Yeah.
But Nebuchadnezzar says, "Nah, you guys are a bunch of fakes. This time around, I'm serious. So what you need to do is you need to tell me the dream and then interpret it." Whoa! You know, nobody ever asked us to do that. I mean, nobody could do that. Because basically what they're saying is we're all a bunch of fakes. We're all a bunch of religious fakes. I'd like to see somebody raise somebody from the dead in one of those churches. Or somebody who had an arm that was completely withered and then shoot. The kind of stuff Jesus did. So anyway, he says, "Well, fine then, I'm going to kill you all." Now, unfortunately, Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, and Daniel were kind of in that group that were going to be executed. So Daniel goes to Ashpenaz and says, "You know, there is a God in heaven who can interpret dreams." And then, so he's brought before Nebuchadnezzar, and Nebuchadnezzar says, "Can you interpret the dream?" And Daniel says, "I can't interpret the dream. But there's a God in heaven." Daniel always gave credit to God. Always. Even if it means he's going to get in trouble. So he tells him the dream. He said, "Nebuchadnezzar, you had a dream of a massive statue, head of gold, chest of silver, belly and thigh of bronze, legs of iron. But one of the iron legs was brittle. And it fell apart. And then you saw another rock that started small, and it grew bigger, and it smashed the statue to pieces, and all that sort of stuff." And then Nebuchadnezzar says, "Oh my Jehovah." He realized there was a God, the God of Israel. So anyway, here's the idea in the statue. Head of gold, chest of silver, belly and thigh of bronze, and legs of iron. Now let's read his interpretation. All right, Daniel chapter 2. Let's read the interpretation of the vision. This is really cool stuff. I'm in verse 35. "This was the dream, and now we'll interpret it to the king. Your Majesty, you are the King of Kings. The God of heaven has given you dominion and power, might and glory. In your hands he has placed all mankind and the beasts of the field and the birds of the sky. Wherever they live, he has made you rule over them. You are that head of gold." Now who set Nebuchadnezzar up as king? Jehovah did. Basically saying, God set you up as king. "After you, another kingdom will arise inferior to yours." Now what is the second kingdom? Remember our brief overview? Okay, basically, Nebuchadnezzar, the Babylonian Empire, is the head of gold. Okay, the Mede-Persian Empire is going to succeed. He says, that empire will be less than yours. Now, you saw the map, right? Which was a larger empire, Babylon or Persia?
Persia
was much larger. You know, Daniel's trying to make him feel better because he's given him some bad news, which is, your kingdom will be defeated by the Persians. Now, of course, Babylon was a much greater city than Persepolis or Susa, or any city of the Persians. So maybe that's what he's talking about. All right. Next, a third kingdom, one of bronze. So which is going to be the bronze kingdom?
Greece.
Okay, got it. Alexander the Great. All right. Finally, there'll be a fourth kingdom, strong as iron. For iron breaks and smashes All right, iron breaks and smashes everything. And as iron breaks and smashes things to pieces, so it will be crush and break all the others. What was the strongest empire in the entire ancient world? It was Rome. And it goes Babylon, Persia, Greece, Rome. What Daniel's doing here is he's outlining the future for the next 2,000 years, roughly. That's kind of impressive, don't you think? Now let's see what he tells us about Rome. Just as you saw, the feet were partly of iron and partly of clay, so it will be a divided kingdom. Now, was Rome a divided kingdom? Well, not until 395 AD. After 395 AD, Theodosius divided the Roman Empire, which was roughly 950 years after this prophecy. Think about it. What was happening in Nigeria 950 years ago, all right? That's a long time. So Daniel told them that Rome will be a divided kingdom. All right? Yet it will have some of the strength of iron in it, even as you saw iron mixed with clay. As the toes are partly iron and partly clay, so this kingdom will be partly strong and partly brittle. Now, what about that? It turns out that Western Rome lasted for about 60 years. And Eastern Rome lasted for 1,000 years. Partly brittle, partly strong. Pretty good. All right? In the time of those kings, in the time of which kings? In the time of the Roman kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom that will never be destroyed, nor will be left to another people. It will crush all those kingdoms. It will bring them to an end, but it will itself endure forever. Now, wait a minute. We read some history books. What kingdom was established during the time of Rome that's still around and is ultimately going to conquer the world? We've got some citizens of that kingdom right here. That's kind of impressive. It's kind of impressive that Daniel predicted the history of the Near East for the next 2,000 years. But I'm telling you, that's nothing. I mean, that is nothing compared to the predictions in Daniel 7 and 8. So let's get to Daniel 7. Okay? Now, you know, for me, this stuff makes me realize one thing I know is the Bible's inspired by God. I mean, there is no book like the Bible. The Quran has none of this stuff. They try to steal prophecies from the Bible and they do it in a bogus way. The Bible is the only book ever written that has these qualities. All right, so there's Rome at its height. Daniel 7 is a vision of four beasts. Let's read about the four beasts in Daniel 7. Okay, great. By the way, the four beasts in Daniel 7 are the four kingdoms in Daniel 2. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel had a dream and visions passed through his mind. Now, Belshazzar ruled from 552 B.C. So now this is 53 years after Daniel went into captivity. How's Daniel doing? He's doing pretty well. He's about 70 years old now, and he's still doing just great. All right, anyway, let me tell you a little bit about it. I'm not going to read the whole thing. So basically, I have a vision of three beasts. The first one is like a lion, and that represents Babylon. By the way, this carving of a lion comes from the gate, Ishtar Gate in Babylon, because the theme animal of Babylon was the lion. And it says the heart of a man was given to it, which is talking about the fact that Nebuchadnezzar came to believe in God. Then he says there's going to be a second beast. It's going to be like, thank you very much, it's going to be like a bear, and it's going to have three ribs in its mouth, and that's Persia. Now, how many empires did Cyrus conquer? Yeah, right, Persia. All right, because the second beast will be like a bear with three ribs in its mouth. How many empires did Cyrus conquer? The answer is three. Lydia, Babylon, and Egypt. All right, so the three ribs in the mouth of the bear are Lydia, Babylon, and Egypt. After them will come a third beast, and that beast will have four wings, and I'll tell you what those four wings represent, but I'll tell you when we get to Daniel chapter 8. But this vision is a vision of the fourth beast. the powerful beast. It's basically, this vision is about Rome. All right? All right. Then in my vision, verse 7, at night, I looked, and there before me was a fourth beast, terrifying and frightening and very powerful. It had large iron teeth. You get that? Large iron teeth? You know what he's talking about, right? It crushed and devoured its victims. It trampled underfoot what was left. It was different from all the former beasts, and it had 10 horns. Remember the 10 horns in Revelation? These are the same horns. While I was thinking about the horns, there before me was another horn, a little one, which came up among them, and 3 of the first horns were uprooted before it. This horn had eyes like the eyes of a human being and a mouth that spoke boastfully. Now imagine you're Daniel. All right, this terrifying beast with 10 horns and then a little horn. And a little horn saying, I'm better than you, the other 11 horns. A little horn knocks out 3 other horns. I got to write this down. I mean, when you first read Daniel 7, what did you think about that vision? That's really weird stuff, man. All right? But I'm telling you, every single thing happened exactly as Daniel was told in the vision. Now, Daniel was wondering about that, and he's given an interpretation of the vision. So rather than complete the vision, let's flip over to the interpretation. Verse 23. He gave me this explanation. The fourth beast is a fourth kingdom. Therefore, it's Rome, right? It will be different from all the other kingdoms. It will devour the whole earth, trampling it down and crushing it. The 10 horns are 10 kings who will come from this kingdom. Now, did Rome have kings? Well, not originally. Rome was a republic. For over 700 years, Rome had no kings. When Daniel was alive, Rome was a tiny city-state, you know, 1,500 miles away that I doubt he'd ever heard about. It wasn't until the time of Augustus in 24 BC that Rome had kings. So that's interesting. Let's read on in the interpretation. All right. After them, another king. After the first 10 kings will rise another king, different from the earlier ones. He will subdue 3 kings. He will speak against the Most High. He'll oppress His holy people. He will try to change the set times and the laws. The holy people will be delivered into His hands for a time, times, and half a time. So according to Daniel, writing in roughly 552 BC, the fourth empire is going to have kings, and the 11th king is going to attack the saints. He's going to knock out 3 other kings. He's going to try to change the set times and the laws. Okay, now let's look at the kings of Rome. You saw something like this yesterday. And the 11th king is Domitian. And Domitian is the first Roman king who systematically persecuted the church and made Christianity legal. How did Daniel know over 650 years ahead of time that it was going to be the 11th king? Now it says, you saw that the text says, he took out 3 other horns, right? Yes. The 3 horns he took out were Galba, Otho, and Vitellus. I gave you an introduction to that yesterday. That's why sometimes it says 11, sometimes it says 8. So what happened was, Nero died, Vespasian was surrounding Jerusalem, fulfilling the prophecy in Daniel 9, but he rushed back. In the meantime, he left Titus to complete the destruction of Jerusalem, and his other son, Domitian, was in Rome, and Domitian battled against, guess who? Galba, Otho, and Vitellius. In the entire history of humanity, how many times has one king defeated 3 previous kings? I mean, that's very unusual, don't you think? How did Daniel know it would be the 11th emperor of Rome? And by the way, it says he would speak boastfully. This guy, Domitian, was so boastful that he demanded to be addressed as my Lord God Domitian. He was the first Roman emperor to demand to be worshipped. In fact, he was so arrogant, his name became a byword for pridefulness. They said, that person is a Domitian. which means he's a prideful idiot, you know, basically. Kind of like a certain president of a certain country. Oops, never mind. No politics here. Oops, I let that slip out. We better replace the recording. All right, there's Domitian. Now, it also says he'll change the set times. Here's what Domitian did. This guy was so prideful, he said, from now on, instead of it being November, it's going to be Domitianus. And instead of being October, it's going to be Germanicus, which was his other name. This guy was so prideful, he changed the set times. How did Daniel know, 650 years beforehand, that the 11th emperor of Rome would take out three other kings and would change the set times? But it also says he would change the laws. And basically, the Roman legal system is considered to be the greatest legal system in all history. Even now, France and South America are under Roman law, essentially. This guy was so arrogant, he said, forget the Roman law. From now on, we're going to have the Domitian law. Notice it says he tried to change the set times and laws. Because the day he died, they changed the months back to October and November, and they returned the Roman law. All right? Now, how's that for an impressive prophecy about 650 years beforehand? Everything happened exactly as God said. Now, imagine you're a Christian. And the year is, say, 97 BC. And you're being told that you can't be in a trade union anymore unless you're going to offer pagan sacrifice. Do you think they could read the book of Daniel? Do you think they could count to 11? You know? Do you think they might possibly have known about Galba, Otho, and Vitellius? I think so. So you see the connection here. Alright, let's read on. Let's read on a little bit here. Alright. It said, but the holy people will be delivered into his hands for time, times, and half a time. For 3.5 years, right? In other words, the bottom line is, God would allow the church to be persecuted. But the fact that the church is being persecuted does not mean that God is not in control. In fact, God is in control. But the court will sit, his power will be stripped away, and completely destroyed forever. Then the sovereignty, power, and greatness of all the kingdoms under heaven will be handed over to the holy people of the Most High. And it happened. In fact, in 325 BC, Rome became essentially a Christian empire, exactly as predicted by Daniel. And then there's Daniel chapter 8, the story about the ram and the goat. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but basically, Daniel has a vision, and in the vision, he's in Susa. And here are the ruins of Susa, and he's looking out over the Ulai Canal. Here's the Ulai Canal. And when you're looking over the Ulai Canal, you're looking to the west, towards Greece. All right? Daniel 8. In the third year of King Belshazzar's reign, I then had a vision after the one that had already appeared to me. In my vision, I saw myself in the citadel in Susa. There's the citadel right there. All right? Oops. The wind changed the page on me. All right. In my vision, I was in the city of Susa in the province of Elam. In the vision, I was beside the Ulai Canal. I looked up, and there before me was a ram with two horns standing beside the canal, and the horns were long. One of the horns was longer, but grew up later. I watched the ram as it charged to the west and to the north and to the south. This is Persia. Now, in the vision, there's two horns. Originally, one was longer, but then later, the other one's longer. And what that's about is the Persian Mede Empire. The two horns are Mede and Persia. Now, before Cyrus, Media was the dominant of the two. But after Cyrus, Persia became the dominant of the two. And it says he charged to the west. The first of the empires conquered by Cyrus was Lydia, to the west. All right? I'm sorry, to the north. Excuse me. Whoop! Whoa! I need to stop moving around, I guess, right? First he charged. Is this one working now? Oh, great. Great. This one also has a little bit more power. Whoops. All right, we'll see if it stays. Again, I need to stop moving around. That's my problem. All right, anyway, he charged to the west and to the north and to the south. So he charged to the west, taking Lydia. He charged to the north, taking Babylon. And he charged to the south, taking Egypt. Again, exactly as said. As I was thinking about this, suddenly a goat with a prominent horn between his eyes came from the west, crossing the whole earth without touching the ground. It came towards the two-horned ram I had seen standing beside the canal and charged at it in a great rage. I saw it attack the ram furiously, striking the ram, shattering its two horns. The ram was powerless to stand against it. The goat knocked it to the ground, trampled on it, and none could rescue the ram from its power. The goat became great, but at the height of its power, the large horn was broken off. And in its place, four prominent horns grew up towards the four winds of heaven. Who is this goat with a prominent horn? It's Greece. And who is the prominent horn? It's Alexander the Great. He charged from what direction? From the west. And it says, it's like he came after the two-horned ram and he shattered him. And like I said, 30,000 troops. When he crossed from Greece, they literally burned the boat so they couldn't go back. Wow. And 3 years later, had completely, utterly destroyed the entire Persian Empire. Josephus tells us that when Alexander came to Jerusalem, they showed him a copy of this vision. And they said, you are the goat with the prominent horn. And by the way, Alexander treated the Jews very, very nicely. It wasn't until Antiochus Epiphanes. So anyway, and then what happened was at the age of 35, Alexander died. All right? At the age of 35, Alexander died. What happened is his generals fought battles. And within a few years, guess how many empires formed from Alexander's empire? Four. There are their names. Antigonus, Cassander, Lysimachus, and Ptolemy. So exactly as Daniel prophesied, the single horn was broken off and was replaced by four different horns, which were the four dynasties that emerged from Alexander's empire. Okay, let's read on here. All right. And then it says, out of one of them, out of one of these four, by the way, specifically the one of the four is this guy Ptolemy. Ptolemy ruled Egypt. Now, what happened was Ptolemy had a general. His name was Seleucus. Seleucus came from Egypt and he fought a battle against Antigonus, who was the most powerful of the four. And what he did was he took Syria from Antigonus. So let's read about that. Remember I told you Daniel is a history book of the future? Certainly true. All right, anyway, it says, so out of one of them came another king. It started small but grew in power to the south, to the east, and toward the beautiful land. Now what Seleucus did was, first he conquered Iraq, or Mesopotamia, to the south. And then he conquered Persia to the east. And then later, his grandson conquered Palestine. That's the beautiful land. Exactly the same order that's said in this prophecy, hundreds of years before it happened. So what that tells me is, not only does God know the future, God determines the future. All right. And then it says here, it grew until it reached the host of the heavens, and it threw some of the starry hosts of the earth, and it trampled on them. It set itself up to be as great as the commander of the army of the Lord, took away daily sacrifice from the Lord, his sanctuary was brought low. Because of rebellion, the Lord's people and his daily sacrifice were given over to it. It prospered in everything it did, and truth was thrown to the ground. This is exactly what Seleucus' great-grandson Antiochus Epiphanes did. He basically got rid of sacrifice. He basically did the abomination of desolation, that Daniel had prophesied, setting up the image of Zeus in the Holy of Holies, and the face on that statue was his face. And now, why did God do this? It says, he did it because of rebellion. Because of whose rebellion? The answer is, because of the Jews' rebellion. I'm telling you, folks, if we're not going to be faithful to God, if we're not going to do His will, if we're going to act pridefully, as if we're God's gift to the earth, He's going to come after us. In fact, He already did. I remember it happened about 15 years ago. Remember that?
Yes.
Yeah, because we were prideful. We said, we're God's gift to the universe. We are not God's gift to the universe. Jesus is God's gift to the universe. We said, we're the only ones, you know. We're so great. We are not so great. In fact, we're nothing outside of God. And God will humble us. And you know, after this time, after this horrible persecution in which thousands were killed and massacred, and etc., after this time was the time of the greatest glory of the Jews. From the time of David to the time of Jesus, the time immediately after what Antiochus Epiphanes did is when the Jews got their political power back. Under the Maccabees, they ruled an area as large as David's kingdom, and the Jews were much more righteous. It's the time when the Hasidim came in, which led to the Pharisees. So God will purify His people. I'm telling you that right now. Then I heard a Holy One speaking. Another One Holy said to him, "How long will it take for the vision to be fulfilled? The vision concerning the daily sacrifice, the rebellion that causes desolation, the surrender of the sanctuary, and the trampling underfoot of the Lord's people." He said to me, "It will take 2,300 evenings and mornings. Then the sanctuary will be rededicated." There's Antiochus Epiphanes, by the way. All right? Now, it turns out that the desecration of the temple happened in late November 167 BC. And then 3 years and 1 month later is when Jacob Maccabeus came in, pushed the Seleucid army out, rededicated the temple. We call it Hanukkah. 3 years and 1 month, which is 1,150 days. See that? 2,300 evenings and mornings.
Yeah.
1,150 days, which if you do the math, it's roughly 3 years and 1 month. That is awesome. Because God predicted the exact length of the abomination of desolation. And if you're one of the faithful Jews, and not many were, by the way, I'll tell you that right now. Very few remain faithful. It's been 1,125 days. You're like, awesome. 25 more days. And it happened exactly, he says. You know why? Because God rules the nations. God's in control. God can take care of your situation. I'm just telling you. Now, the way He takes care of your situation may not be your idea of what He ought to do. But I'm telling you, what He has for you is better than what you have in mind for you. I'll tell you that right now. I guarantee you that. All right? But that's not even my favorite prophecy. Oh, no. Now, I'm going to finish up in about 7 or 8 minutes. I don't have much more time. And I'm going to have to go through this pretty quickly. But then there's Daniel 9. Oh, Daniel 9 is great. So Daniel's praying. He's having a quiet time. He's reading the book of Jeremiah. And he notices, Jeremiah says, 70 years. The year that he's reading this is roughly 538 BC. So Daniel's been in captivity for about 68 years. All right, he says, you know, God, come on! Come on! And it says, while he was praying, God sent angels to answer his prayer. And he says, you know what, I'm going to deliver my people. But it's not going to be 7 years. It's going to be 70 times 7 years. Then I'm going to really deliver my people. Let's read about that. Starting in verse 24. 70 sevens are decreed for your people in your holy city to finish transgression, to put an end to sin, to atone for wickedness, to bring in everlasting righteousness, to seal up vision and prophecy, and to anoint the most holy. Know and understand this, from the time the word goes out to restore and rebuild Jerusalem until the anointed one, the ruler comes, there will be 7 sevens and 62 sevens. It will be rebuilt with streets and a trench, but in times of trouble. Now, what is this decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem? Well, it turns out Cyrus issued a decree. It's in Ezra chapter 1. But the decree was to go back and rebuild the temple, not the city. And there was another decree in Ezra chapter 3 in which Darius says, guys, go back and build the temple. No, it's in Ezra chapter 6. It's the decree of Artaxerxes. And it's in the 7th year of Artaxerxes. He said, go back and build the city. And that's when they went back and rebuilt the city. You can read about that in Nehemiah. Okay, the year was 458 BC. Now, 70 times 7 is 490. How do we know it's 490 years? Because the prophecy concerns 70 years. All right, now, 458 minus 490 is negative 32. That would mean 32 AD. Except for the fact there's no year zero. The calendar goes from 1 BC to 1 AD. So according to this prophecy, at roughly the year 33 AD, the anointed one is going to come where? To Jerusalem. To bring in everlasting righteousness, to be anointed as the most holy one, and to bring an end to prophecy and revelation. Wow, that's a pretty accurate thing. Now, if you read the prophecy, see where it says 70 sevens, 7 sevens and 62 sevens? Actually, what he's saying is during the last week. So the detailed interpretation is basically somewhere between 26 AD and 33 AD. The actual year Jesus was crucified was probably 30 AD. So here we have a specific prophecy of the very year that the Messiah would come to Jerusalem. And interestingly, based on a decree that wasn't issued until 100 years after Nebuchadnezzar, after Daniel died. That's pretty amazing. All right, and then if you read the rest of Daniel 9, he talks about the abomination of desolation. He talks about the defeat of the Jews under Titus. Remember Jesus said, you know, when you see the army surrounding the city, leave, because the abomination of desolation is spoken by Daniel is about to happen. That's Daniel 9. I don't have time to do Daniel 10 and 11. But actually, Daniel 10 and 11, that's even more specific. I mean, it is so ridiculously specific that even the enemies of Christianity know this has to be true. So they claim Daniel was written after the events, which can't be true. Because Daniel was found in the Dead Sea Scrolls, and Daniel was translated into the Septuagint translation by 200 BC. But anyway, so let's skip to Daniel 12, because I got to finish. I'll just take about 3 more minutes here. It brings it all to a close. Now, just like in Revelation, where the last 2 chapters fast forwards the end of time, right? The book of Revelation is about things that will soon take place, except for the last 2 chapters. Similarly, Daniel prophesies things that were going to happen historically in the future, but then the last chapter in 12, he shifts forward to the end of time. So he's going to tell us what's going to happen at the end of time. Let's read about it in Daniel 12, verse 2. Multitudes who sleep in the dust of the earth will wake. Some to everlasting life, others to shame and everlasting contempt. Those who are wise will shine like the brightness of the heavens, and those who lead many to righteousness like the stars forever and ever. You know what? I believe that I will live even though I die. Jesus said, I am the resurrection and the life. I believe that I will be raised from the dead. You know why I believe that I'll be raised from the dead? Because Daniel said so. Daniel said the fourth empire would be a divided kingdom. One half strong, one half weak. Daniel said the 11th king of the fourth kingdom would persecute the saints and take out three other kings and change the times and the laws. Daniel said that the prominent horn would come from the west and destroy the two-horned ram. And when he died, he'd be replaced by four. And then a fifth would come. And then a descendant of that fifth would change the take away the sanctuary and set up the abomination of desolation. And that 2,300 evenings and mornings later, the sanctuary would be rededicated. And Daniel said that 490 years from the issuing the decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem, the Messiah would come to Jerusalem. And it happened. And then Daniel says, at the end of time, we'll be raised from the dead. Some to everlasting righteousness. Some to shame and everlasting contempt. I want to be amongst those who rise to everlasting righteousness. And he says, basically, it's an evangelism. We're going to talk about evangelism. The rest of this day, you know what we're going to be talking about? We're going to talk about our plans. And our plans are to do exactly what it says here, which is we're going to lead many to righteousness. Amen. You know, there's plenty of room for more stars. And thousands of those stars are going to rise from Nigeria. Amen. And because of the effort of the brothers and sisters in this room, they too will rise to everlasting life. Amen. God rules the nations. God expects that we will be faithful. That we won't just believe in our mind that He rules the nations, but in our hearts that He's in control. Do you believe that God's in control? I do. Let us live that way. Thank you.